This message entitled, What We Do in Life Echoes in Eternity. Part 2, Passion for Mission, by Ray Lowe, was recorded at the New Frontiers Together in a Mission Conference 2008 in Brighton.
Such a small, tiny island. And yet over the centuries we've had a huge impact on other parts of the world, particularly in terms of the Christian faith. And I suppose when I look at church history, the thing I see more than anything else is the sovereign hand of God. And you can read all sorts of historians, and particularly secular historians, and they'll give you all sorts of reasons why things happen. And there's a lot of truth in what they write, but behind it all, or over it all, is the sovereign hand of God. And so what I want to bring you today is really something about the whole thing of mission. Let's go back, shall we, to 180 AD, to the reign of Marcus Aurelius. I mentioned him yesterday, the man who wanted to be remembered as a philosopher, just found that the Germans were giving him trouble. They were pressing in on his empire, looking for territory. And that great film, The Gladiator, our hero is Maximus. Yes? Now, ladies, have you seen this film? How many of you ladies have seen it? Did you see the whole of it, or just a quarter of it, as you shielded your eyes? But nevertheless, there's those wonderful Maximus! Maximus! I mean, just, you know, the hero. And he gathers his cavalry, his senior troops, before the last battle after 19 days of fierce fighting. And these words that he speaks to them when he says, what you do will echo in eternity. And an amazing thing. A hero. But what I want to do, and I tried yesterday, and I want to do today, is really introduce you to some real heroes. People who, what their exploits really will echo in eternity. They're still echoing down to us, and will go on. And one day we'll have the pleasure of meeting them face to face. I often say when I'm queuing up to meet Jesus and I'll be in the back of the queue, I'll probably pop off for a couple of decades and spend some time with Martin Luther and George Whitfield and William Carey and a few others. But that's going to be the wonderful thing, that all these people that we study now, we can ask them, yeah, what really happened? You know, what was it like? And so Maximus, hero of Gladiator, there are some greater heroes. I was in Portugal a few weeks ago. I flew over on Friday, and I came back on Saturday, and I did the lectures on the early church and the Reformation, and I was absolutely clapped by the time I got home, particularly as it was with translation. But I engaged with a church I'd never visited before, wonderful group of people. And as usual, I stayed with the pastor and his wife. I just said to them very casually, well, how did you happen to be here? And they told me a story that they'd been there for 25 years, Mike and Jessica. But they told me the story of their father, who had come as a missionary in 1910. And the more and more I listened, I said, this is amazing. Will you please put it down on writing? Send me an email. Give me a few details. I just want to read this to you. This is their email. Eric Harold Barker was born in 1899 into one of the early Brethren families. His father was H.P. Barker, a well-known international evangelist. Eric himself was preaching on Hyde Park Corner by the age of 16. 1917, he joined the Navy during the First World War. His ship was torpedoed, and while he was swimming in the sea, he thought, if I am willing to give my life for king and country, how much more should I be willing to give my life for the King of Kings? On arriving home after a ministry trip to Jamaica, which had involved a stopover in Portugal, Eric's father told him of the deep need, spiritual need in Portugal. So in 1920, age 21, with one suitcase and £5 in his pocket, he arrived in Portugal to be one of the first pioneer missionaries to the country. He came by faith with the blessing of the Brethren Assembly, but no promise of support. Indeed, the money for his fare out of Portugal was given by a member of his assembly after the service of commissioning. On arrival, he went to live with a Portuguese family putting aside his English Bible in order to learn Portuguese more quickly, and within 6 months was preaching in Portuguese. Sometime later, he was asked to travel north to a village south of Porto, that's where I was, in Porto, to take the funeral of a man who was the only evangelical Christian in that area. When my dad got there, he anointed the man with oil and prayed for him, and the man was healed. That was the start of his first church in the north of Portugal. He returned to England to marry his fiancée and then settled down in the area of Portugal and began evangelizing. He and a Portuguese colleague took a covered wagon drawn by a mule from fair to fair, selling Bibles and distributing tracts. Eric played his mandolin and sang to draw a crowd and then preached the gospel. Persecution was intense from the Catholic Church, which was hand in glove with fascist dictatorship, and also from the relatives of new Christians, with people often losing their jobs, being stoned, beaten up sometimes, and imprisoned. In 1933, he moved to Porto, and over the next few years, he planted 5 churches in and around Porto, and also helped with the planting and establishing of several others. In 1942, the consul told all the English to leave Portugal, as they expected the Germans to invade as a means of getting to North Africa. Eric stayed in Portugal, but his wife and 7 children were evacuated. Their ship was torpedoed and they all died. On the Sunday morning, when Dad received the phone call giving him the tragic news, he went to the church and told them that he had just had news that his family had arrived safely home. So it's amazing, isn't it? His faith had been an inspiration to many. Dad's faith was firmly founded on what he read in the Bible, and he expected to see what he read about in Acts. So healings and deliverance from demons were pretty normal in the life of the church in those days. Several people were healed on their deathbeds. 1946, he married again, another amazing story, she puts in brackets, and had 5 more children, including me. Eric died in Portugal in 1989, aged 90. His wife is still alive today, aged 93. In 82, Mike and I sensed that God was calling us to Portugal. And in April 83, we set off with 2 very small children, all our belongings, an old converted ambulance, and pulling a trailer. We had the blessing of our local FIEC church, but received our first firm promise of support as we got on the bus to drive to Portugal. After a year of language learning for Mike, God called us very clearly the Penafiel. In that year, he trebled the money we had from selling a house in Lee so that we were able to buy outright the house he led us to in Penafiel at the time, etc., etc., etc. Wow, what a story! What a story! Now, folks, when I heard that story, you know, I thought to myself, why do people do such things? Because sometimes, you know, even Christian people, I hear Christian people say, why are you throwing your life away? Why do you want to do that? You could have such a promising career. Why would you want to do something like that? And I think that's what I want. I want to try and answer sort of that question today for us, because we're part of a movement where people are doing that. I was lecturing church history in Bournemouth a few months ago, and they were very, very young, very, very young men and women, much younger than I'm used to, usually full-time ministers on that course. None of them were full-time. I think there was one. I said, well, I don't know you and you don't know me. Tell me who you are. With almost without exception, as they gave their name, they said, Vision Going to the Nations. That's the first time I've heard that in that way. Usually it's going church planting, going to the nations. So as a movement, at the moment, God is catching us up in this whole thing of the nations again. Because God is interested in fulfilling the great commission. So I believe there's something in our genes. So how come this tiny island has been responsible for sending so many missionaries overseas in the past? Well, let's just talk about this little island for a minute. Anybody know where Christianity started, this little island? Albans? Well, we know the first martyr came from St. Albans. Well, it was Alban in the Diocletian persecution in the early 4th century. But you know, long before that, Christianity was on our shores. 20,000 Roman soldiers came here very early on. Certainly were here in the first, second century, certainly under Hadrian. And we know that there were those that were converted, that were part of their legions. We also know that we were a nation of trade, and the Romans colonized us, so a lot of wheat and stuff went out from here, pottery, glass. We did a lot of trade with Gaul, and there were Christian communities there. We know from Eusebius that he speaks of those going over the seas to a place called the British Isles. We also know from other very early historians that some English bishops attended, particularly some of the church councils in France, probably 3rd, 4th century. I think, I'm not sure, somebody would have to correct me, but I think there were English bishops at the Council of Nicaea in 325. So there was something of an established church, even though Christianity was outlawed in this country as well as the rest of the empire until 312, when Constantine was converted. So there was something of a church here. We don't know how strong it was, we don't know how many it was, but certainly it was. There were Christians here during that Roman period. And someone has mentioned that the first martyr was St. Albans. Sadly, the Romans had to leave in the very early part of the 5th century, mainly because of the threat to Rome itself. And so some 20,000 Roman soldiers left. They left a small remnant to defend their shores, but they didn't last very long either. And so Saxon invasion took place in the 5th century, and historians more or less agree that by that mid-5th century, most traces of Christianity had disappeared by that time, and England need re-evangelising. Now, the reason I want to take you through this early part, because often we talk about revivals, don't we? I had some students together recently. I said, when you think of revival, who do you think of? Give me some names, of Wesley, Whitfield, and all the rest of it. And I said, well, the earliest name you've given me is in the 1730s. So what happened before all that? And most people don't know. You've got to revive something that was there, something that actually became a corpse. So I want to just give you something of the history of our nation up to this sort of, to the time of revival. So we've got some idea of what was going on. Because when you look at our history, you realise there were battles that were being fought in our nation way back. So come about the 6th century, we needed re-evangelising. And really it came from two sources. The first source was that Augustine came from Rome in 596. And the story goes that Gregory, Archdeacon of Rome, he saw these slave boys and girls being sold in the slave markets in Rome. And they were fair-haired and quite nice-looking. And he inquired, who are they? And he was told, well, they are angels. And he said, they look more like angels. And God touched his heart. And he planned that he would come to the British Isles, and he would come to evangelise. On his way, unfortunately, the Pope died. And he was then himself elected as Pope, so he had to go back. So he commissioned Augustine to come, and he landed at Thanet in 596 with 40 monks. And he was welcomed there and made his way to Canterbury, where he met Ethelbert, King of Kent, who had a Christian wife and who was soon converted, and really, really opened up certainly Kent and the south of England to take the gospel. You can just imagine the weird sight of all these sort of Italian priests walking around in their garb, sort of sharing the gospel. Some 28 years later, Ethelbert's daughter, this is in 624, marries Edwin, King of Northumbria. The condition is this, the marriage condition is this. And if you trace the history, you'll find some very godly queens that were married to some pagan kings for political alliances, to make sure that they weren't warring with one another. You find God uses that a number of times. But the condition was this: I bring my own religion with me, and I bring my own priest. And she took with her an Italian priest called Paulinus. And Paulinus is famous. If you read Bede's history of the church, the first historian of the church, he tells the story of how Paulinus, this tall, dark-looking Italian priest, goes before the king and his thanes. We don't know the gospel that he preached. All we know is this. The result was they decided wholeheartedly for Jesus. The whole lot were converted. Again, we have to put that in inverted commas a bit, because what does that mean? But 10,000 of them were baptized in one day. And if you go to York Minster today, you'll find that the spring that they were baptized in is there in the font of York Minster. Sue and I were there only a couple of weeks ago. So that's amazing. So the beginning of the reawakening, if you like, of the church there through this guy, Paulinus. So that was very much in the south, him moving up to the north. But there's another source which I just love. Was really originating with St. Patrick. Now, if you're Irish, I'm sorry, St. Patrick was an Englishman. St. Patrick probably came from Cornwall. We really don't know, but all we know is he was nicked by Irish pirates. At 16 years of age, he was kidnapped with his two sisters, and he was taken to Ireland, and he was there for 7 years before he escaped. But God really touched his heart while he was there. He was a young Christian man before he was kidnapped. And somehow his heart was, I need to go back to Ireland. I need to take the gospel to the Irish. He went and he studied in a French monastery, and then went back to Ireland. And by the time of his death in 465, he had evangelized Ireland. He planted monasteries, lots of Christian colonies were established, centres of education and civilisation, and centres of evangelisation throughout Ireland. And really, it's to his disciples that we look to find how the north of England then began to be fully evangelised, because his disciples followed his model. And one of his disciples, one called Columba, went to Iona. Now, I've never been to Iona. It's one of the places I'm... Anybody been there? Yeah, it's a fascinating place. But they started this community, just like Patrick did, in Ireland. And this Columba, for 34 years, he oversaw the Irish church, undertook missionary journeys throughout Scotland, little frail wooden boats that they travelled in. They went as far as the Orkneys, the Hebrides, and even to Germany, evangelising. So within them was this spirit of wanting to take the gospel. In 633, a Christian king called Oswald managed to unite the north after much bloodshed. And he looked to Iona, really, for Christian help. And from Iona was sent a guy called Aidan. And Aidan established Lindisfarne. Anybody been to Lindisfarne? Oh, visit it. It's a fascinating centre of Christianity and of learning there. The only thing with Lindisfarne is you've got to be careful when you drive across the causeway, because if you don't time it right and you come back a little bit late, you lose your car, because it just fills up with water. But a fabulous place to go. It's on the A1, about half an hour out from Newcastle, up the A1. It's on the right. It's worth a visit. And so out from Lindisfarne, Aidan sent missionaries to evangelise that other half of England. And so by the 8th century, England was under one Christian king, having been evangelised by these disciples of St. Patrick, one end of the country, and Augustine, the other. And they were already sending missionaries to other nations. So even back there, we have a history of sent, receiving and sending. It's in our genes, folks. And you realise that what God has been doing with us, it's not only sort of powerful and good, but it means that there's a lot up for grabs. There's a lot at stake. And it is reckoned that the darkest year of church history for England was probably the blackest year, 787 AD, because of Viking invasion. Now, I just want to explain something about the Vikings, because they hated the name of Jesus, absolutely hated the name of Jesus. And when they came, again, seeking territory, their intention was to wipe out every trace of the name of Jesus that was possible. I don't know about you, I was reading in Ephesians 6 this morning, I think it was, where it says that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. Now, it always comes in the shape of flesh and blood, doesn't it? But nevertheless, behind it is that demonic spirit. I think that the demonic looks through to what could be and thinks, let's deal with it, let's cut it off now. And I think in our nation, when we look back to this year, we see something of that. That there was so much up for stake. And basically, again, historians, and most of the historians I've researched on this stuff over the last few years, I have to go back 100 or more years because nobody writes about this stuff at the moment. But they destroyed everything. Lindisfarne was destroyed, all his wonderful writings and stuff that was there. Also the libraries and the church at Canterbury. So by 866, it is reckoned that most traces of Christianity again have been destroyed. The last outpost of resistance was from our famous king who burned the cakes, Alfred. And Alfred was fighting a last-ditch battle on the Somerset marshes and wins an amazing victory despite overwhelming odds. Now, folks, I want to say this. When you go through our history, you will find there are a number over the centuries of battles that we have won, which we ought not to have done. This is one. Another such is the invasion of the Spanish Armada in 1588. And the other is when you go back to the last World War, how the Luftwaffe was defeated over the skies. You know, really, when you look at it, one has to say, here, there is a sovereign hand that has protection over us. And not least of all, there in the 9th century, that King Alfred won an outstanding victory against overwhelming odds. And the Danes were forced to make terms, and the terms were this: you either quit England or you become Christians. The last Viking invasion was in 1013, and guess the name of the one who came to invade? His name was Sven. Now, we've had a Sven in our recent past who hasn't done us a lot of good, but this one came, and horrible destruction, but he mysteriously dies. And he is succeeded by his son, Canute. Now, we know about Canute because we know about they so loved Canute, they thought he could stop the sea and all that sort of stuff. We haven't got time for that today. But his son, Canute, comes to England with the most powerful army. And it looks as though we are going to be under Viking rule. He is wonderfully converted, amazingly converted. And he then begins to send missionaries from England to Denmark and Scandinavian countries to evangelise there. So, when you look at it, you have to say, Lord, you must have a plan and purpose for this little island way beyond its geographical or political or anything else. It doesn't make us proud, but it does make us responsible. Let's just realise that, God has got a purpose for us, and that purpose is ongoing. We have a tradition, despite all the demonic opposition, as we come to William the Conqueror in 1066. Have you seen the film Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves? Actually, William doesn't have a very good press there, but he was quite good. He was a Viking himself, actually. He was a rogue. But he had a rightful claim to the English throne, despite Harold's resistance of him. But one of the things he realised about England was this. England was vulnerable, being an island. Him being a Viking, he began to make us a maritime nation. So when you come into Elizabeth's reign, you find that when we are facing a huge force against us, we are ready for it. So we do owe a little bit to William the Conqueror. Now I want to go 400 or 500 years. I want to jump down. Sorry if this is boring you. I don't mean to, but it's just good to see where we've come from. 400 or 500 years, we go from William in 1066 to the Stuarts at the end of the 17th century, and then to William and Mary, and from there on we don't have any English kings and queens. That's another story. But what we find is this: we are preoccupied as a nation with constant struggles. First of all, with Rome, with Henry VIII and his break with Rome, and all the wrangles with his divorce from Catherine of Aragon. We mentioned it a little bit yesterday. And then with the Stuarts, we find his Parliament and King, the struggle which leads us to a civil war, Oliver Cromwell, all that sort of stuff. And basically Europe is plagued after the Reformation with religious wars. What this results in is that there's no missionary advance at all as far as the Protestant church is concerned. Catholics have been sending missionaries for centuries, but a lot of that had to do with imperial domination. Not totally, but certainly has had something to do with that. But in terms of Protestantism, there's been very little Christian mission. 1620, time of James I, the sailing of the Mayflower, the Pilgrims and the Puritans make their way to New England in order to find religious freedom. They begin to evangelize the Native American Indians, which they rely on basically for their lives. The highlights of the 15th century, as we looked at yesterday, was the invention of the printing press in 1450, and the Turkish invasion of Constantinople in 1451, and the bringing out of the ancient documents for study. And out of that comes these English versions of the Bible. We looked at that with Tyndale yesterday, and the wonderful authorised version. It meant now the tools are in the hands of those who want to go and preach the gospel and teach them the scriptures. And the Reformation was a great move of God. But basically what the Reformation did was this. It rediscovered, it brought again to the church the doctrine of justification by faith. But the downside of the Reformation was 100 years of religious war. And during that time, very little was happening in terms of fulfilling the Great Commission. And what about the Great Commission? What was happening in England as we come to the end of the the 17th century? Morally, we were bankrupt. Morally, we're bankrupt. Spiritually, we were pretty dead. Deism was the in vogue. Deism, and a God who is absent, like an absentee landlord that's set a few conditions for people to live in, but really not very interested, led to a denial of most of the foundational doctrines of the faith, and particularly a denial of anything that's supernatural in terms of our faith. Usually, when that sort of thing happens, there's no life around. 30 years later, of course, the Great Revival comes for England with Whitfield and Wesley. But, the amazing thing about church history, and this is what I like about church history, is this. When things look grim, God's always at work somewhere. It's always true. When things are at their lowest, God is working somewhere with a little group of people who are faithful, I've got vision, I'm praying, usually meeting in small groups. You'll find the small group thing is where you find the life. And we find here that this is where really Protestant missions begin. And I want to sort of major on a guy called Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf. Now, some of you have heard of him and you've heard of the Moravian missionaries, but I doubt whether we know very much about them. They're almost the forgotten people of the post-Reformation era. So I'm going to give you some stuff. He was born in 1700 and he had the title of a count. His parents were godly Lutherans, but his mother died when he was very young. His father married again, and the outcome of that he was brought up by his grandmother, another godly woman, and came under the influence of, at a very early age, of a strand of Christianity which we call the Pietists. Now, again, these names you never adopt for yourself, but someone else gives you. Is a very brief description of what the Pietists were after. They really sought to know Christ in a very personal way, believed that Christ was knowable in that way, and to live a life that was totally pleasing to him and fulfilling his commands. I guess in that sense we're all Pietists here, aren't we? Yeah. I mean, that's what we want, isn't it? The Lutheran church by this time had become very formal, had become very institutionalized. There wasn't the life in the Lutheran church that there was a hundred years or more before. What had come out of Luther, unfortunately, didn't have the zeal and enthusiasm of Luther. here's what one of his biographers say about him, and I'm going to read quite a bit from various biographies. He said, the young Count grew up in an atmosphere bathed in prayer, Bible reading and hymn singing. His dearest treasure next to the Bible was Luther's smaller catechism. In childlike sincerity, he wrote love letters to Jesus and tossed them out of the window of the castle tower. When Swedish soldiers overran Saxony, they entered the castle at Gross Herrendorf and burst into the room where the six-year-old Count happened to be at his customary devotions. They were awed as they heard the boy speak and pray. The incident was prophetic of the way the Count was to move others with the depths of his religious experience the rest of his 60 years. Young Lutz, as he was called, was not allowed to forget that he was a Count, even though growing up in this pietist environment. He was tutored and trained, disciplined and cultured for the future service in the court. At the age of 10, Zinzendorf said farewell to childhood. He went off to Halle to attend the Pedagogium, which I can only believe was a college for young men, young women, of the staunch pietist disciple, August Frank. There, Zinzendorf spent his next 6 years under the watchful eye of a tutor assigned by his guardian, Count Otto Christian. And under the very nose of Frank himself, he and a few others, sons of the nobility, took meals in the Frank household. His pious ways and highborn status, together with a rather frail constitution inherited from his father, made him a target for the taunts and tricks of his peers. Zinzendorf proved himself an apt pupil. At the age of 15, he could read the classics and the New Testament in Greek, was fluent in Latin, and French was as natural to him as his native German. While not excellent in Hebrew, he showed definite poetic gifts. One biographer says he often was able to compose faster than he could put his thoughts on paper, a gift he retained for life. He wrote thousands of hymns, and it was an influence of the great Charles Wesley in his hymn writing. This is an account from his diary when he was 15 years of age. He says this, this week I began the plan of spending a whole hour from 6 to 7 in the morning, as well as in the evening from 8 to 9, and for 15 minutes at quarter to 10 in prayer. Also, I resolved to pursue the study of civil law with all my energy, since I expect all sorts of interruptions this coming summer. Examination with Mencken. At 10 o'clock, I fenced. At 11, I studied the pandects. I don't know what they are. At 12, I dined. At 1, I played badminton. At 2, I drew. At 3, I attended the lecture in the history of the Reich. At 4, I danced. At 5, Bardin, my French tutor, was here. At 6, I studied civil law. At 7, I dined. At 8, I prayed. At 9, I studied Hoppe's examination. So he was quite a young man. Moved on to Wittenberg University. Wittenberg, made famous by Martin Luther. And he was really torn with this responsibility if you know, in Saxony, it was part of the Holy Roman Emperor, and Saxony, those that held this rank in Saxony had a particular political responsibility, and so he was torn really between: do I pursue my political responsibilities, or he really wanted to be ordained as a Lutheran pastor. So at Wittenberg, he mixed with a lot of different types of people, particularly Anabaptists and others, and had a heart for church unity. After his studies, he travelled widely with his half-brother, Frederick Christian. He visited centres of learning in Holland and Paris. He came to London, and he mixed with all sorts of people. But it was in Dusseldorf that he had an experience which the shape the remainder of his life. An art gallery there, Domenico Fetti's Ecce Homo, which is Greek for Latin for behold the man, he was looking at this picture. And below this picture was an inscription which went like this: I have done this for you, what have you done for me? And this was his reply. He said, I have loved him, but never actually done anything for him. From now on, I will do whatever he leads me to do. In 1721, when he came of age, he purchased from his grandmother her estate at Berthelsdorf, he married Countess Irma Dorothea von Roos, also a devoted pietist, and his vision was to establish and form a Christian community which would have impact, particularly on the whole area of Saxony. And so began a venture that was to have worldwide influence that seems to have almost been forgotten about by modern church historians. Right, now, time-wise, where are we? I got into trouble yesterday because I went over time. So what time?
35 minutes.
I've got 35 minutes left.
Oh, no, you've done 35.
I've done 35 minutes. So what does that give me left? Another 40, doesn't it? Right, yeah. If I go over time, you're responsible this time. It'll be your honorarium, not mine, that they'll be taking it from. Okay, just so that you know that. Okay, so I've got 45 minutes. Are you with me? Are you okay?
Yes.
So it's amazing. Be careful when you go to art galleries. Be careful of art galleries. But it's interesting how God uses things, doesn't he, to arrest me. You know, burning bush for Moses and for Zinzendorf. Just a picture of the Lord there in this art gallery. And again, you look at how do you get a Christian community going? How do you get it off the ground? Well, you need a visitor. And he had an unexpected visitor. And here again, a biographer says, all the while the vision filled his mind, it was to form a Christian community at Berthelsdorf, modelled on the Countess's home in Ebersdorf. This vision was not too long in finding fulfilment with the arrival of a lone Moravian at his door in Dresden. The man identified himself as Christian David. He had heard that Zinzendorf might allow oppressed Moravians refuge on his land. Large-hearted Zinzendorf agreed to the request, but was not even at Berthelsdorf when the first group of 10 Moravians arrived in December 1722. Johann Georg Heitz, the manager of the estate, greeted the immigrants and showed them a plot of ground a short distance from the manor house at the foot of the hill, Huttberg. Christian David quoted Psalm 84:1 as he laid his axe to the first tree that he was to cut down to build the first home there. He said, "Yea, the sparrow hath found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself." And now he had found the place where he wanted God to place him. Informing Zinzendorf by letter, Heinz said that Christian David had chosen a name for the settlement. It was to be Herrenhut, meaning under the Lord's watch, or on the watch of the Lord. Not until Christmas time did Zinzendorf pay any attention to the 6 adults and 4 children who had come to live on his land. Passing the new dwelling in his carriage, he and the Countess stopped at the Moravian house and prayed with these with whom he sensed at once a spiritual kinship. 17 months later, in May 1724, Zinzendorf was at the Huttberg settlement for a special occasion. His vision of a community taking shape. He and a small party of trusted friends had come to lay the cornerstone for the first large building, which would house an academy, similar to the one at Halle, a print shop, and an apothecary. With him was his close friend, etc., etc. Coincidentally, 5 young men from Salzenthal in Moravia, 3 whose name were David, arrived that day. They had left everything behind them, and stealing across the border under cover of night, were on their way to a Moravian city in Poland. When Christian David persuaded them to visit Kernut, these men were of the hidden seed of the ancient Unitas Fratrum. Now, let me just explain who they were. Remember yesterday, I mentioned Jan Hus of Bohemia. Well, after Jan Hus was betrayed and was executed, put to death, there were really what came out of that was a church that broke with Rome. And really, these people they formed this community, and Zinzendorf was to take the constitution of that old community and really rewrite it as the values of his new community. So what was happening? These people that had been followers of Huss are now making their way, the Moravians, to find Zinzendorf and form the nucleus of his community. All right, have I explained that well enough?
Yeah.
Okay, because this is not easy stuff to get hold of. By May 1725, 90 Moravians had settled at Herne. 10 times Christian David journeyed back home to lead groups of settlers to the new town. The three houses really grew into a small city. Many of the new arrivals told thrilling tales, tales to tell of the ways in which sympathetic Catholic friends had helped them escape. Zinzendorf, as I say, adopted their constitution. The 13th of August of that year was to be a special day. Now, you find in church history, there comes a time when there's a genuine move of God that you can look back to and know that God did something by the Spirit. You find it in Wesley and Whitfield later. I think it was New Year's Eve, 1738. They knew a visitation of God as they fell on their faces and the Spirit of God came upon them. And the same thing here with Zinzendorf. You find it time and time again in church history. What happened was this. There have been squabbles, there have been disagreements. People have been falling out with one another. Living in community is not easy. But he, Zinzendorf, had prepared this day and had visited everyone. And it was to be a day of reconciliation. He had a great heart for unity. And it was as they gathered, the Spirit of God came upon them. And his testimony is, we were baptized in one Spirit that day. Amazing. Amazing. And what followed over the next couple of years was a building up of the community into a church. Small cells played an important part. And what these small cells did is they met for mutual correction, study the scriptures, for prayers. They appointed leaders from those cells who then travelled out, particularly in Saxony, to other parts to establish other cells and raise up the same sort of thing elsewhere. If you know anything about Luther did the same throughout Saxony and then throughout other parts of Germany that opened up to him 200 years before. So it's very much, in fact they call him the second Luther. Very much employed Luther's methods. And so there was that time when the Spirit just came and baptise them. And as his biographers say, the missionary call was inevitable. It had to happen. It was what had to follow from what God was doing. A guy called Weinlich, who's a Moravian historian, he says this, from this ministry to the diaspora, and that was the scattered Moravian groups that there were among Saxony and beginning to be further afield, it was but one step to another kind of itinerary, going as gospel preachers to the forgotten peoples. Three factors at least made the missionary action of Herne almost inevitable. He says this, first, the settlement had a contagious brand of Christianity. Lots of people went there. Wesley was deeply affected when he went there, influenced very much the missionary movement. A little different theology, but very much adopted. We think of Wesley and the small groups. Well, this is where basically he got it from. Secondly, its leader was a count with entry to the ruling classes of many lands, and it says whose restless nature moved him to make use of this advantage. And then further, the Moravian exiles were uprooted pilgrims who took readily to the vocation of itinerant evangelism. It was in their blood. They were used to. And I'm not sure if this is correct, but I think those that settled in Moravia, I think also they came out of, remember I mentioned yesterday, the persecution of the Anabaptists by Ulrich Zwingli, a sad event that took place there in Zurich and others. Well, okay, there's a linking up here with all of them, that there's roots in there. The outcome was this. Zinzendorf was invited to be present at the coronation of King Christian VI in Copenhagen. He didn't want to go, but it was the opinion of the community that he ought to go, that somehow he should be there. And it was when he was there, he met a black man named Anthony Ulrich from St. Thomas in the West Indies, who pleaded with him to send missionaries to that island. This is what the biographer says. For some time, a number of the single brethren at Helnut had been led in the study of writing, medicine, geography, and theology by Zinzendorf, against the day when they might go to other lands. Now, Zinzendorf hurried back to Helnut to report what Anthony Ulrich had said to him. Two of the young men definitely impressed by Zinzendorf's words were Leonard Dober and Tobias Leupold. After a sleepless night, Dober arose the next morning and opened his 1731 daily text, seeking to know if his strong thoughts about going to the West Indies were of God. The text was, "It is not a vain thing for you, because it is your life, and through this thing you shall prolong your days." It says, but Zinzendorf knew better than to act too quickly. For a year he allowed Dober and his friend to wait, while all of them weighed the issue in prayer and much discussion. No clear-cut unanimity within the community was found, and it was decided to submit the matter to the drawing of lots, which was very much one of their things. In August 1732, a drawing of the lot indicated that Leupold was to wait, but for Dober it is said, "Let the lad go." The 25-year-old lad was sent, and David Nitschmann, the carpenter, agreed to go with him. They immediately made plans to sail for Copenhagen. This is what the biographer says. "There were not two men in the world more fitted for their task. Each had a clear conception of the gospel, each possessed the gift of ready speech, and each knew exactly what gospel to preach. At an unforgettable service on August the 18th, the Helnut congregation said farewell to the two brethren, their first missionaries to be sent. 100 hymns were sung. So intense was it. They worshipped. They sung hymns. I remember years ago, we used to sit under the ministry of a guy called Wally North. It was really a Wesleyan, in fact, I think a pietist, to be honest. And some of Wesley's hymns used to have 32 verses. Hymns of eternal length, we call them. And we used to sing them, and somebody would say, "Can we sing that again, please?" 64 verses. So never complain that one of your worship leaders are singing this song too many times. 100 hymns. Wow. How amazing. Now, they had to make their way to the Netherlands to catch a boat. Nobody would take them. No one wanted to know. Eventually, they found a boat that would take them. They were 10 weeks at sea. They were told they would die anyway. They'd never survive the voyage. They did. And he says that Dober laboured amongst the slaves there in St. Thomas for 15 months, began to see some. So he starved to death almost once and was sick of fever. 17 more volunteers arrived after 7 months at sea trying to make that voyage in a bad, bad state. In 3 months, 9 had died. 11 more arrived. By 1735, 22 of the first 29 had died. Wow. What do you make of that, folks? It says this, "Yet the tide of missionaries continued to go from Helnut. In 1733, three brethren went to Greenland. In 1734, Moravians went to Lapland and Georgia. 1735, Suriname. 1736, Africa's Guinea Coast. 1737, South Africa. 1738, Amsterdam's Jewish Quarter. 1739, Algeria. 1740, North American Indians. Ceylon, Romania, and Constantinople. The golden decade of 1732 to 42 stands unparalleled in Christian history insofar as missionary expansion is concerned. More than 70 Moravian missionaries from a community of not more than 600 inhabitants had answered the call by 1742. Thousands eventually went from this church, this one church community. The influence, when you read it, I've been researching it. I've got to confess, Terry Virgo a year ago asked me if I'd do something on the Moravians, which I said, "I don't think there's enough to do on them. I don't think. And I stumbled across this almost by mistake. I can imagine probably Mr. Virgo was on his knees or something. But when I looked at it, I thought, wow, these people were amazing. Why have we so forgotten them? This was their influence. Incalculable influence. They had a 100-year prayer meeting, for goodness sake. A prayer meeting when every hour of the day for 100 years people were praying for the missions. Sins and Dorf wrote thousands of hymns, particularly influenced Charles Wesley. The influence on John Wesley was immense. Wesley was crossing the Atlantic and there were some Moravian missionaries. The ship was going to go down. Wesley was fearful for his life because he knew he had to stand before God. The missionaries were singing hymns and praising God. Later, he said, how could you do such a thing at such a time? He said, because we know we'll be with Jesus. He said, you cannot know that. And really, when he got to Georgia and he began to live amongst them, he was so impressed with their lifestyle. And particularly, one of them became his very, very close friend. A guy called Peter Buhler. And Peter Buhler, one of the great teachers of this movement. It was him who encouraged Wesley. Because Wesley was saying, I have no faith. He said, preach faith till you get faith. And it was on the 24th of May, 1738, listening to a reading of the preface of Luther's commentary on the Book of Romans by Buhler, that it was that the Lord met with him and he said, my heart is strangely warmed and I know my sins are forgiven, even mine. And that was the beginning of Wesley's ministry. Whitfield, of course, had been labouring for 5 years before that. Here's some things that are said about them. Donald McGavin, Fuller Theological Seminary, probably one of the great missiologists of his time, and certainly church growth specialist, says this. Between 1550 and 1750, while the Roman Catholics were most active in Christian missions, Protestants were doing practically nothing. Cut off from the rest of the world by Spanish and Portuguese navies in the west and Muslim armies in the east, they confined themselves to North Europe and North America. About 1750, Count Zinzendorf and the Moravians burst on the scene with missionary fervour. They saw that to be genuine, Christianity must be concerned about those who had yet to believe in Christ. They were the first glow in the east after a very dark night. Another guy from Fuller, Paul E. Pearson, Dean of Fuller Theological College, says this. Well, over half a century before Carey, the Moravians became the pioneers of the movement that would establish the evangelical church in every nation on earth. The Moravians were unique. Later European missionary societies will be composed of small minorities with their churches. The Moravians soon became committed to world missions as a church. That is, the whole church became a missionary society. Because of this deep commitment, this small group furnished over half the Protestant missionaries who sailed from Europe in the 18th century. They became the forerunners and models for the growing streams of missionaries on the 19th and 20th. Now, how long more have I got?
About 25 minutes.
Really, as long as that? Well, my goodness. Okay. One unexpected influence. Now, I've always been a fan of Carey, William Carey. I am a great fan of William Carey. And if you want some great lectures, then I've done some on William Carey. And you can get them at no price. Just get in touch with us and we'll let you have them. But I've always believed that the influence on William Carey that provoked him to missions was really reading the Captain Cook's diaries of his journals of his trips around the South Seas and sort of all the sort of people he encountered there. But I found this. It's amazing what you can find. Here's a quote. It says this. For some years, William Carey, the leader of the famous Serampore Three, had read the Moravian periodical accounts. So this was their journals. He referred expressly to their work in his pamphlet and his famous, what we shorten and call the Inquiry, an inquiry into obligations of Christians, the means for the conversion of the heathen, and at Kettering, that was the Northampton Baptist Society meeting, where he appealed to the example of these Moravians. This is what he said. See what these Moravians have done. Can we not follow their example? And in obedience to our heavenly master, go out into the world and preach the gospel to the heathen. Now, this is what the commentator says. His word meant more than most readers generally suppose. He was referring, when he said Moravians, not only to Germans, but to Englishmen. According to one modern writer of mission history, William Carey, the founder, with the other ministers of the Baptist Missionary Society, was the first Englishman who was a foreign missionary. This statement is incorrect. For several years before Carey was heard of, a large number of British Moravians had been toiling in the foreign field, in Antigua, in Jamaica, in St. Kitts, in St. Croix, in Barbados, and in Tobago. So there were Moravian missionaries that were English that had been sent out on mission before Carey. But Carey himself was stood. Now, let's just think of Carey for a moment. We've got 25 minutes. Let's just think of Carey and what Carey achieved. Carey was a cobbler, for goodness sake. Zinzendorf was a count. Could they be further afield in terms of their background? But both had the same seal. And he was influenced by Cook's travels and Captain Cook. If you know anything about Cook, he was a commoner, and as a commoner, you did not rise to the rank of captain of a ship. But he did. And he travelled around the South Seas. And in his journals, he said this. He said, everybody is going to the South Seas. What a place to go. Yeah. Explorers, entrepreneurs are going, medical people are going, scientists are going. The only people who won't go there are Christian missionaries because there's nothing for them there. And this stirred Carey's heart. And what Carey did was this. He had on the wall of the back of his cobbler's shop, which was also a classroom as well because he taught, he got a map of the world. He began to collect data of all the various nations of the world. In fact, it became such an authority for centuries of the nations of the world. And he collected all the data, and his heart was this: we need to fulfill the Great Commission. He went to the Northampton Baptist Society meeting because he was a Baptist pastor by this time, and he said to them, is not the Lord's word to the first apostles, does it not run down to us? Should we not be taking the gospel to other nations? And he had all this data which he produced. And I think it was Fuller, and I think his descendants have denied this, who said, young man, if God wants to convert the Indians, he'll do it without your help and without mine. It was very much what we would call the days of hyper-Calvinism. Now, I'm a Calvinist by conviction, but hyper-Calvinism is when you follow it too far, when you can't balance the sovereignty of God and responsibility of man. And basically says, that's God at the end of the day anyway. What it does is makes us complacent and lazy. But he wouldn't take that. And eventually, he pushed it through so that the Baptist Missionary Society was formed. They took an offering of £13, 2 shillings and sixpence, of which Carey was so poor he couldn't contribute a penny, but he volunteered to go to be the first missionary in India. But it's obvious that it was these periodical accounts of Zinzendorf's movement that also stirred him and his own writing of this inquiry. And the Baptist Society was formed in 1793. He went to India. He was disowned by the English, and the East India Company wouldn't give him a license. He took refuge under the Danish flag, and he achieved amazing, amazing things. After 7 years of labour and ministry, most of us would have sacked him by that time, and in fact the Baptist Missionary Society did. But he got his first convert, Krishna Pal. Before his baptism, there were riots, 2,000 rioted. He set up a community at Serampore and set about translating the scriptures. In 1809, this was what was said in the British Parliament. 2 years after the abolition of slavery, Wilberforce, he worked and laboured with Wilberforce for the abolition of slavery and the abolition in India of a lot of other things that were cruel practices of the Hindu religion. This was what was said in Parliament of William Carey and those who laboured with him. It says this: these low-born and low-bred mechanics have translated the whole Bible into Bengali and have by this time printed it. They are printing the New Testament into Sanskrit, the Orissa, Marathi, Hindustan, Gujarat, and are translating it into Persic, Telangar, Kannati, Chinese, the language of the Sikhs, and of the Burmans. And in four of these languages, they're going on with the whole Bible. Extraordinary as this is, it will appear more so when it is remembered that of these men, one was originally a shoemaker, another a printer in Hull, and a third the master of a charity school in Bristol. These low-born, low-bred mechanics have done more towards spreading the knowledge of the scriptures among the heathen than has been accomplished or even attempted by the whole world besides. Where did the motivation come from? Come from these Moravian missionaries, not just the secular accounts of Captain Cook. In fact, they translated parts of the Bible into 23 different languages. By the time he died in 1834, he said this: I have not a single desire ungratified. He said, expect great things from God, attempt great things for God. By the time of his death, he saw over 1,000 converts, established 19 mission stations in India. He had 50 missionaries, of which only 6 were Europeans. He had a training college for future leaders. He was an amazing man. Because someone sparked, God sparked someone somewhere. It's amazing, isn't it? What can happen? He became known as the father of modern missions. And I guess Sindendorf, we might say, was the grandfather of modern missions. We could go on, Hudson Taylor, C.T. Studd, if you want stuff on C.T. Studd. Done lots of stuff. It's all on tape. It's good stuff as well, believe me. It's good stuff. We could go on. We could talk about John and Betty Stamm. We could tell of these two young Americans in the 20s, 27, 28 years of age, and died at the hand of communist soldiers, beheaded in 1930. Baby miraculously smuggled back to the United States. At their memorial service at the Moody Bible Institute, 700 volunteered at that one service for service on the mission field. We could talk of Nat Saint, Jim Elliot, and those sort of people, and I want to recommend this film to you, The End of the Spear, if you can get it. Have a look at it afterwards. Do a missionary evening. Great, great, great story. Tells it vividly. Tells of Jim Elliot, Nat Saint, other friends who were speared to death by hostile Amazon Indians in the Ecuador basin, and of how Elizabeth Elliot went to live amongst them and took the gospel. I had the privilege of meeting Elizabeth Elliot some years ago. She's a very elderly lady now, quite formidable. Femme formidable. And I was invited because our church has been involved in missions and it was known for that. So I was one of the privileged to meet her. And she said this. She said, you know, in our day, there was no such thing as furloughs. They guaranteed you one thing only. They would get you there. Oh, my goodness. And she talked on discipleship and I felt, I've done a lot of teaching on discipleship. I'll keep it quiet and such things. Oh, amazing. These people were amazing. But their inspiration came from elsewhere, and we could go on and we could go on, and I'm going to go on because I've got a little more time, haven't I?
Yeah.
How do we pastor this sort of thing, folks? We're all leaders here. Yeah. We've got to pastor this stuff. It's not enough just to have stories from the past, because God has called us to mission now. So how do we pastor this? I want to give you two things, and I want to finish with a story. If you're a church leader here, don't be surprised if some of your best want to go to the nations. They want to leave you. Because we're living in those days where they're going to want to go. Because the Spirit of God is stirring again, just like he did with Zinzendorf, just like with Carey, and he's done with others. Hudson, C.D. Studd, we can go right down, Gladys Aylward. All these people got stirred because it was such a time as for stirring. So don't be surprised if your best want to go. It's healthy. Folks, don't discourage it. I know church leaders that don't want to lose their best because they want to build good churches and they won't let them go. And I think often they're standing in the way of God. And so what we need to do is encourage. We need to... Our vision needs to be the ends of the earth. If your vision in your local church is less than that, you've missed it. Because we've got to have Jesus, his vision. One, we want to build the local, but we build the local to reach the world. That's what we do. That's the mission we're on. I have also, no, I haven't got any time for that. I'm too busy doing this, and I'm not going to let my young men go. Dave Devnish comes around and keeps preaching these sermons, and they all want to clear, and no, I'll keep them away from Dave Devnish. I've heard that. I'm serious, I've heard that. I say, that's terrible. You know, it's the ends of the earth. That's why... And when you think in the West, we're so privileged, we've got so much. and we're called to give it away. So encourage them. And secondly, get your church involved in mission. And there's so much that we can do, and we do within New Frontiers. There's lots of short-term missions that young people, old people, people even my age can go on and really get involved. And John's here from the Suited there. I'm so glad to have him. I met John, how many years ago, John? 10 years ago? He was a young man, I was almost. And I remember going out there to Steve Oliver out there in Clarence, in the Drakensberg and the Sutu, and getting involved. I remember preaching there once, went through a month preaching on the Acts of the Apostles, and after the fifth day, I was teaching Acts of the Apostles, they came back and they said, Mr. Lowe, what do we do now? I said, what do you mean, what do we do now? They said, well, we've done it. Well, what have you done? Well, what you taught us, we're going to plant a church in Bethlehem. No, Golden Gates, that was it. Why did you do that? Well, that's what you taught us. Well, I'm not used to people doing what I tell them to do. In the West, people just learn, they don't do it. Wow, what a privilege. So, and we've taken teams out there, and particularly Gareth, who pastors the Church of Biggin Hill now, he's taken teams out there to all sorts of things. Get caught up in that sort of thing. It'll do more for you than it'll do for them. Get something in the system. Adopt a nation. Adopt a nation. There are nations here amongst our church. Adopt one. We've adopted a number in our time, particularly Mexico, where I've personally been involved and taken teams for many years. South Africa, China, couples in China, Tajikistan. It's been great to have this involvement. People serving out, they're praying for them, bringing financial aid, but also visiting, going out and actually supporting. Have a mission evening. Show this film. And get hold of this sort of stuff. And then begin to... And ask someone who's from another nation. Here, somebody you get to know. Here, could we support you? And that's how we pastor this stuff. And we encourage it. We don't just think local. Let me finish with a story. I've got time for a story.
Yeah, okay.
Good man. I don't care if we go over anything. We do this every year. I was speaking at our fiesta celebration in Mexico, in Guadalajara, beautiful place in the mountains. We have about 1,500 of our Mexican friends come, and it's a great time. And I was asked if I would like to have breakfast with a pastor. I can't even remember his name now. I think it was Felix, but I think I'm wrong. But I've been through the alphabet so many times. I said, sure, John Evans out there, my friend who leads part of the team out there, he said, you'll love to have breakfast with this guy. It was a Methodist pastor. And a Methodist pastor from Chihuahua. That's where the dogs come from. And over the border into Mexico. And he told me this story. That he'd been a Mexican pastor for some years. He was... they were pretty liberal. The denomination was pretty much getting ready to close down. And a couple of years before, he'd heard a voice tell him to go to a place called Topeak. Now, Topeak is on the Sierra Madre, a very mountainous area, lots of forests and rainforests and what have you. And anyway, he ignored it, like you do. He ignored it, and this voice kept coming back periodically. Eventually, went to the head of his denomination, he told them, and they said, well, we don't know what that's about. We really don't believe that's of God, because we don't believe, that sort of thing. But if you want to go, we've got an old building there. You can go and you can have it. And anyway, we're closing down, so, you're on your own. So anyway, in his car, he went and he drove quite several hundred miles. And on the way, he was robbed, beaten up and robbed. There was real discouragement. But he got to Topeak and he found this old building and he opened it up. Sent for his family, and his family began to minister there. Unknown to him, a tribe of indigenous Indians living up in these mountains, heard that a Christian mission had opened, and they carried for 10 days a man that was just absolutely crippled, carried him on a bed, and they took him to the meeting. Now, this guy did not know that they were in the meeting. He didn't even get to pray for this guy because God sovereignly healed him. What happened was this: over the next few months, he noticed he was getting his visitors every Sunday. What he didn't know was these visitors took 3 days to walk to get there and took 3 days to get back. So they were, you know, pretty fit people by the time they'd been to church a few times. And after a while, he thought, well, I need to pay these people a visit. It took him 6 days to get there. And he tells them hilarious stories of crossing rivers and all sorts of things. And when he eventually got there, he was invited to share and preach the gospel, saw many people saved, and many, many miracles and signs and wonders. Amazing things. The outcome was this. That he has now discovered 72 indigenous tribes. Some of them sort of headhunters. Would that be the right? And cannibals. And he's now got more than 1,000 people there who have turned to Christ. And he's now training them up and sending them out to these other villages. And he told me of this very moving meeting they had where some of these young couples were going, not knowing whether they would ever come back. Not knowing, but prepared to put their lives on the line. Now, when we think of mission, you see, we don't think of this sort of thing. We think, oh, well, that's all gone, all that AUKUS stuff, that's all finished. Folks, there's a world out there yet to be discovered, yet to receive the gospel. It's in our genes. The Great Commission is in our genes. So, you know, we've moved from Maximus, who's fictitious, and all the rest of it, and we can join a Friday afternoon when we're fed up with the people we've passed. Maximus is a good sort of relief, but that's all he is. The real heroes are the people down the history, most of whom we don't even know their names, but they've got a vision, the vision of Jesus for the nations. Yeah. And folks, that's what this, our movement and other movements around the world, and there are many of them today, is all about. It is, we build the church to reach the world. We build the church to reach the world. So I hope that has stirred you, that mission is in your blood. And if your pastor is at another seminar and he hasn't got mission in his blood, then please give him a bad time. so that we do get on get our hearts where God's heart is at this prayer. Tonight we're going to be hearing from around the world what we're doing. We're going to be giving, and so it's appropriate to do this seminar this time. Now I'm going to take some questions in a moment. You may turn it off now. And have we done it?
Yeah.
Good. Your honorarium is intact.